When Iran's soccer team played South Korea, the fans had their mind on a bigger clash at home.
They are doing something that has not been done for 30 years. The people were quiet for 30 years. They were shut down and their voice would not be heard in anywhere else. But now is the time that their voice is being heard in all of the world.
No winner in the soccer game between South Korea and Iran. It was a 1-1 draw abroad. But at home, who knows what the end result will be. We're following the action in Tehran this morning on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, June the 18th. I'm Femi Okay. John Hockenbury is away, but Catherine Lamfer is here for the entire day. Hi, Catherine.
Hey, Femi. Coming up this hour, we, of course, will keep getting updates on Iran. We're also going to chat with New York Times editor Bill Keller. He just left Tehran. Plus, some economists can see the end of the recession. So why aren't they smiling? Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
In Iran, opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi is urging protesters to wear black to a rally scheduled to start about 1 hour from now. He's declared a day of mourning for those who were killed while protesting the country's contested presidential election. Incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was declared the winner in last week's election, but opposition candidates say the voting was rigged. Meanwhile, the White House is denying charges from the Iranian government that President Obama has been meddling in the election. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs.
I think the president has rightly observed what has happened and the events that the world is witnessing, while underscoring, as he said, the universal principles that he believed are important.
A statement shown yesterday on Iranian state TV accused Washington of interfering in the protest. Catherine.
Now here in the U.S., automaker Chrysler will reopen 7 assembly plants by the end of June. This comes after it stopped work at all of its factories for 6 weeks while filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. This also includes factories in Michigan, Missouri, Ohio, and Mexico. A Detroit plant that makes the Dodge Viper sports car restarted earlier this week. There's also new evidence in the Air France plane that crashed off the coast of Brazil last month. The evidence suggests that the plane broke apart in air and that there was not a fire on board the flight. This is from an analysis of the bits of debris pulled from the ocean surface. Also, officials in Pakistan say 8 people are dead after a suspected U.S. missile strike. The attacks apparently targeted Taliban hideouts, and the death toll may rise as villagers dig through the rubble.
So one key economic indicator to keep an eye out for today, jobless claims from last week. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow and S&P both fell 0.1% and the Dow opens at 84.97. The S&P opens at 9.11. So economists say that the recession might end this summer. Yay! But do you believe them? Tell us, how will you know when the economy is getting better by filling in the blank?
The blank?
Yes. Yeah,
so what do you mean?
When I see the price of blank go down, then I know the economy is getting better, or at least it isn't getting worse. What is your blank? Is it gas? Is it milk? Is it me taking you out to lunch? Tell us 8778MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
John Hockenberry is away. I'm Catherine Lamfer.
And I'm Femi Okay. Protesters continue to demonstrate their disappointment with the presidential election results in Iran. We begin this morning by going live to Tehran, where Iranians are preparing for a day of mourning organized by the opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi. Joining us from Tehran is Babak Degapanche, and he's the Middle East correspondent for Newsweek. Babak, welcome back to The Takeaway. Set the scene for us this morning. What have you heard? What's happening?
Thanks, Femi. I think we're looking at a potentially chaotic afternoon ahead. As you mentioned, the supporters of Mir Hossein Mousavi are planning a large rally here in Tehran. They have been urged to wear black to commemorate the deaths of protesters who were killed earlier in the week. But what could be, again, potentially chaotic or clashes could break out is the fact that the opposition or the other side, Ahmadinejad supporters, have also called for a rally roughly at the same time in the same area. And they've been urged to come out on motorcycles, which could, really sort of complicate things between the two groups.
It's difficult to know how authorities are going to treat the demonstrators. It's almost like every protest is slightly different. Are you getting a sense of how authorities will look at the opposition protests this morning and today?
It's hard to say exactly. As you mentioned, it is a bit unpredictable. In general, the police forces and the anti-riot police, even though they had taken part in violence against the protesters earlier on. In the past couple of days, they've been, they've relatively been calm and sort of sat by the wayside as the protesters go by. But I think the people who we see sort of instigating the violence against the protesters are a lot of plainclothes security people, and it's almost impossible to identify which branch of the security forces, if any, they're affiliated with.
As you've been doing your reporting, are you getting any feeling of fear from people who are going out on the streets at all?
Surprisingly, no. There's a lot of there's a sense that people are taking part in something that's necessary for those who are disputing the vote. They feel there's a sense of unity between them, and again, surprisingly, that there isn't much fear, even though there has been this violence and these deaths.
What's happening with the vote count? And we've been so concerned and so focused on protesters and people getting out on the streets, the violence that's incurred in some places. But what about the vote, Babak?
Well, there's not a whole lot of significant progress on that. So far, the Guardian Council has been urged by the Supreme Leader to look into any reports of irregularities. And they have said that there may be investigations into certain areas where there are reports of irregularities. That's about it. There's no, there's no planned recount, widespread recount of the vote at all at this point.
Now, I asked you last time you wanted to give us a headline for this morning for our audience waking up in the U.S., but I know you've got a little bit of a tidbit for what's happening on Friday and the prayer services. So tell us about that.
Right. Well, the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has planned to lead the Friday prayers tomorrow. That's that's a rare thing. He only comes out to Tehran University to lead those prayers maybe 3-4 times a year. So I think we can expect some sort of significant message from him tomorrow. Now, whether that will appease the protesters, whether that will calm people down about the disputes over the votes, that's a completely separate question.
Babak Degampache, he is the Middle East correspondent for Newsweek. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me bring into the conversation an editor who's just fresh back from reporting in Iran and covering the elections there. Bill Keller is executive editor of our partner, The New York Times. He's joining us from London. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So, editor of The New York Times, you actually went to marshal your forces out there in Iran, Tehran, and see how they were doing, and then you started writing.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I do these kinds of trips a few times a year. I think editors should get out and spend some time with their correspondents. That's the only way you can really get a sense for the nuances and texture of the stories that we run. I generally don't write when I'm there. I just watch. But this story just exploded while I was there, and it was kind of all hands on deck.
When you were there, did you get a sense that you were writing history? I'm following some of your reporters' notebooks. You talk particularly on the day after the vote of people almost coming down from this awful high and feeling a great deal of despair.
Yes. You have to be careful about analogies across cultures, but I've, in my reporting days, covered a couple of pretty historic moments, including the end of the Soviet Union and the end of apartheid. And this felt like it was in that category. Whether the outcome will be similar is impossible to tell at this point. But yes, it feels like something quite important is going on in Iran.
One of the big stories that has come off the back of the presidential elections in Iran and then the coverage afterwards has been the part played by the internet, by social networking, microblogging like Twitter. Does that make you feel comfortable or do you feel threatened by that?
No, I think that's a truly important phenomenon. It's, you know, Iran is a controlled society, but it's not really a closed society. And one reason it's not is because of things like text messaging and websites. And a lot of Iranians, you know, particularly the middle class, are on Facebook. I mean, it's an important internal phenomenon, an organizing tool for the campaign. And when the government hasn't shut the systems down for the post-election protests as well. And now, as they're trying to basically purge the place of outside press, it'll be incumbent on these systems to supply us with information about what's going on there. I think it's an important, you know, supplement for all of us. It's not perfect. You know, for one thing, the government is reasonably good at shutting down these systems, at least sporadically. And for another thing, Iran is a place that where rumors run rampant, and so it's very hard to know, if you're not there witnessing it, you know, how much of the stuff that comes across Twitter you can trust.
Right. Catherine, it's also interesting. I want you to talk about how you were able to do some reporting there and write, when we hear all these other stories of reporters who are told that they can't. If you're on the outside looking in, how come one guy gets to write and one doesn't?
Well, I'm on the outside myself now. I mean, I left when my visa expired.
Right, but you were writing from there.
Right, I was writing from there, and other reporters have been too. The people who stopped writing first were the people whose visas expired, and they were told that they would get no extensions, and they gave no extensions that I'm aware of to non-resident press. And then on, Tuesday, midday Tuesday, they announced that all working press were supposed to stop working. That is to say, even if you have a visa, your official press credentials were officially revoked, and they said anybody who went out to cover the story would be taking, you know, the risks in their own hands. And people did anyway. People have kept writing. A lot of them have anyway. But it's another thing to just stay on illegally when your visa expires, because it is a relatively efficient police state.
As you were writing your reporter's notebooks, you were saying that change was too unsettling. Are you sticking with that analysis, or as the days go by, do you feel that there's some other explanation for what's happening right now?
You mean, well, change was too unsettling to the leadership, for
yes.
Sure, and to some of the public. I mean, you know, doing a sort of systemic review of public opinion in Iran is extremely difficult. Obviously, you know, most of the reporting focuses in Tehran, which is you know, the capital and a big urban, fairly cosmopolitan place. A lot of Iranians don't live in Tehran, although most Iranians do live in cities of a million or more, so it's a pretty urbanized country. But, you know, that said, Ahmadinejad clearly has a real following. He is a populist and quite a skillful populist politician. He put a lot of money during his 4 years as presidency into sort of spreading the wealth around among civil servants, the military, pensioners, people like that. And there are a lot of Iranians who actually like the kind of paternalistic quasi-theocracy of the Islamic Republic. It makes them comfortable. And there, as we are seeing, a lot who do not.
Bill Keller is the executive editor for the New York Times. You can read him in the New York Times. Bill, have a safe trip back to the States. Thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
You're welcome.
Now, also coming up later on this morning, we're really looking forward to this guest. His name is Professor Hamid Dabashi. He is a professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University here in the U.S. He knows everything there is to know about Iran. It struck me, Catherine, if our audience has any questions they want to know about the current crisis in Iran, that they should actually call us and we can ask questions for him.
And one of the other reasons I'm excited about having him on, you know, Bill Keller was just saying, you don't necessarily know what the tweets are telling you. He knows who's tweeting him. He knows who's emailing him.
1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org for your questions about the Iranian elections and the protests.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253. I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.